Well, thanks very much for that introduction, and it's a real pleasure and a privilege to be here and to talk about what is a fascinating but also, I think, deeply troubling area about how advances in technology are affecting our understanding of what it means to be human. As you've heard, I'm basically a baby doctor. My background has been working in looking after critically ill newborn babies, and that area of medicine is an area which has been transformed by technology, and therefore we were working often with babies right at the very limits of viability at 23 and 24 weeks of gestation. And yet in the very same hospital, just one floor away, is the fetal medicine unit, where pregnant women are referred from a wide area of London and South East England when an abnormality of the fetus of the unborn baby is detected. And a little known fact of the way the law works in the UK is that it's actually legal for abortions to be carried out at any stage throughout the whole stage of pregnancy, all the way up till term. And in my hospital at UCH in London, on a regular basis, late abortions, or so-called feticides, are carried out 26 weeks, 28 weeks, 30, even 36 weeks gestation. And on many occasions, I've been called away from the neonatal unit, where we're struggling to save the life of a tiny preterm baby, to go and talk to a mother, a pregnant mother, who's considering having an abortion. And the baby in her uterus is considerably more advanced and stronger than the baby that we're struggling to save one floor down. And you ask yourself, how is it possible for these different approaches to what it means to be a human at the beginning of the life to happen in one health service? And it's an interesting question, and it's a complex question. But that's rather a shocking introduction, but that's actually how I got into ethics, by being confronted by these kind of extraordinary challenges. And of course, that very dilemma is created by technology, both the technology which allows us to keep very small and sick babies alive, and the technology which allows us to detect abnormalities in the womb, have created a profound and troubling dilemma about how we as a society treat beings at the beginning of life. And I think one of the themes of my talk is to use a philosophical term, is the quest for self-transcendence, that human beings have a desire to understand who they are at some deep and existential level. And what is a new idea is that it's technology which is going to help us understand ultimately what it means to be human. So it's interesting how much focus there is on comparing human DNA, or what is called comparative genomics, comparing human DNA with the DNA of close relatives, including the chimpanzee. And there's a lot of effort going in at the moment into this area in order to compare base by base human DNA with chimpanzee DNA. There's only a relatively small percentage, possibly 1 to 2% of the coding regions that are different in these two species. And the argument goes, if we can understand what those 1 to 2% of DNA actually does, then we will understand what it means to be human. We will understand what is the difference between the chimpanzee and the human. And of course, as we know, the idea that by looking at animal behaviour we will understand more about what it means to be human is, of course, a very dominant theme of research and of so-called sociobiology and so on. And the theory goes that by understanding, for instance, primate communities, we will see how morality and altruism and other what were previously thought to be distinctively human characteristics we will be able to understand how they evolve and how they give a survival advantage and so on. So on the one hand, then, there's a comparison between the human and the animal, but there's also the comparison between the human and the machine. So this is taken from a textbook of cell biology, a standard textbook, and what it shows is under the microscope a brain cell, a neuron, this thing, which is growing and sending off dendrites and so on top of a microprocessor. And the text goes on to explain that really these two things are the same, and that we are performing the same function, and that we will be able to understand the way the brain functions by looking at the way a microprocessor functions. And again, this is a big theme of modern cognitive psychology, is really taking the ideas of software modules, software programming, and saying, let's apply that to the way the human brain works. Of course, there's an interesting circularity here, because, of course, who invented the microprocessor in this diagram? Answer, it was ultimately human designers. The microprocessor is the product of the human brain, or human brains. And now we hope that by understanding how a microprocessor works, we'll understand how a human brain works. Well, at one level, arguably, that's a bizarre form of idolatry. In Isaiah, Isaiah has a wonderfully coruscating passage where he says, he talks about the folly of the man who goes into the forest, chops down a piece of wood, half of it he burns to keep himself warm, and the other half he turns into an idol and then bows down and worships it and says, "You are my God." What utter folly. Well, in some sense, this is a 21st century version of the same phenomenon, to take a product of our human hands and minds and then think that this will explain ultimately who we are. But the idea that neuroscience is going to give us insights into ultimately understanding the human brain and the human person is very dominant. This is an MRI scanner, and this is taken from a website called No Lie MRI Inc. And the idea is that by placing subjects inside the MRI scanner, by giving them various questions, you see the form of brain activation. This is a new version of the lie detector. But it's already being suggested that these kind of techniques will find a role in the law courts for testing evidence. They're also, MRI scanners are cropping up in all sorts of places. They're now apparently being used to test adverts, so that after you've spent your £500,000 on your latest car advert, you then play it to volunteers inside an MRI scanner. You look to see what kind of brain activation you're getting. You then tweak the advert in order to optimise the brain activation. This is being suggested that it's now going to be used for employment screening, so it's said that you can detect prejudices and hidden unconscious processes by using MRI scanners. People are using it to look at moral dilemmas. So this is just taking a paper, consequences, action, and intention as factors in moral judgments. Well, that sounds pretty straightforward sort of moral philosophy, but no, this is an fMRI investigation. So the idea is that we're going to understand ultimately how moral agents, how humans work and moral agency by looking at the nature of brain activation. And so, for instance, it has been suggested that when people evince moral disgust, when they are being asked, would you do something which they would find morally offensive, the same circuits are activated in the brain as happened with tasting a disgusting taste. And so this is being used to say that this is, the argument then goes on to say that this is a sort of primitive emotional response. It's not a rational thought response and so on. And perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised to see that the neuroscientists are also extremely interested in this bizarre phenomenon called religious belief. And a lot of different kinds of religious believers are being put into MRI scanners when they're praying and they're meditating and they're doing various other activities. Of course, there's a subplot here. The first author is Sam Harris, who's very well known as an atheist apologist, somebody who is very active and very scornful of religion. But he's also a neuroscientist who is using fMRI in order to identify and understand the nature of brain activation in religious believers and so on. So you can see the subplot. Especially you can see there's going to be some kind of new therapy that's going to be, if we can give you the right kind of treatment, then all those sort of pesky religious beliefs which are causing so many problems in society are all going to be nicely erased, and you're going to become the same as the rest of us. So behind all this is really a quite crude version of determinism. And it's interesting that determinism, of course, is not a new idea. Philosophically, determinism has been around right from the ancient Greek philosophers. And there are lots of different versions of determinism as here. But it's the last two which are the new variants. There's genetic determinism, that in the end we are determined by our own genetic sequence. Ultimately, it's our DNA which determines our actions. Or this version, neurological or neuroscientific determinism, that ultimately it's brain processes and brain mechanisms which determine. And all forms of determinism ultimately conceive of the human being as a form of puppet. We're ultimately puppets who dangle with different kinds of strings. And any illusion that we have self-control is purely that. It's purely illusory. We are, in fact, determined by hidden and utterly inalienable forces. And it is also interesting to see how historic Christianity has always been opposed to all these different versions of determinism. Historic Christianity has always said, yes, we are influenced and affected by many forces, but no, we are not determined. No, we are not puppets. Ultimately, we have the dignity of choice, of moral choice, and we are held accountable for the choices we make. And we can't just say it was my neurons what made me do it. Of course, there is a sort of circularity behind all this kind of reasoning, because if you say that I'm programmed to believe in God, well, of course, you too must be programmed, and therefore you must be programmed to believe that I am programmed, and so on. So ultimately, this kind of neurological determinism leads to the end of any kind of intellectual debate and any kind of quest for meaning or truth, because in the end those things fly out. All there is mechanism. The mechanisms are whirring away, and there's no hope that we might ever find truth. So it's ultimately self-defeating and profoundly circular. And of course, it's interesting that the problem that evolutionary explanations of brain mechanisms of rationality, there's a very profound problem, because if our brains evolved in order to give us a survival advantage on the African savannah, which is the received wisdom, the only reason why this runaway evolution of the brain happened is that it must have provided some primary survival advantage on the African savannah, then we have no reason to think that the products of our brains, that the thoughts and convictions and beliefs that our brains come up with, have any relationship to reality. All that you know is that they will help us to improve our survival. But our brains could well be feeding us with complete folly and untruth and self-deception in order to enable us to survive. And it's interesting that Charles Darwin, in this famous passage from one of his letters, had spotted this problem. But then with me the horrid doubt always arises whether the convictions of man's mind, which has been developed from the mind of the lower animals, are of any value or at all trustworthy. Would anyone trust in the convictions of a monkey's mind? If there are so if we can't trust a monkey's mind, why should we trust a human mind? And so there is, again, a fundamental problem of circularity there. So to put it in a slightly simplistic way, in conventional thinking, these kind of beings were seen as entirely separate. There were human beings, there were animals, non-human animals, who were our cousins and relatives, but who were fundamentally different. And then there are artifacts that we make, that are the products of the human mind and of the human person. And what it seems to me is happening is that there is a conceptual blurring between these boundaries. So the distinction between what it means to be animal and what it means to be a human being is increasingly becoming blurred. And at the same time, the distinction between what it means to be a human and what it means to be a machine is being conceptually blurred. And so the net effect, I think, and the threat for human identity is that the distinctiveness of what it means to be a human in the cosmos is under considerable threat, and will ultimately, that it will disappear, and that all we've got are animals and machines in some kind of mixture. But this kind of machine thinking has also profound ethical implications, because if human beings are merely machines, then we can exploit them for our own purposes. So inevitably, this kind of machine thinking leads on to instrumentalization, the idea that we can exploit human beings, and particularly that the strong human beings can exploit the weak. And there are many examples of this already, of the way that biomedical technology has within it this great potential for instrumentalization of the weak. But just one example is that as we speak, there is a global trade in organs. Human organs are passing around the world. There are kidneys and corneas and heart valves and livers, and there's sperm and there's eggs. And they're all passing around the world in a commercial trade. But perhaps we shouldn't be too surprised that if you look at what the net flow of organs around the world, most of this is, some of it is licit and is open, and some of it is illicit. We shouldn't be too surprised to discover that, by and large, organs are passing from poor bodies to rich bodies. They're passing from young bodies to old bodies. And they're passing from female bodies to male bodies. And there are well-documented cases of really quite appalling abuse that is taking place. For instance, there are quite well-documented cases of prisoners being executed to order in order to supply organs which are demanded in rich Western countries and so on. And so there are many other examples you could cite, but it just shows how that medical technology always has this dark side, a dark face. And although it's presented as something which is bringing human benefit and blessing and fulfillment to human lives, it has another aspect. And in the prescient words of C.S. Lewis, in that very powerful short book, The Abolition of Man, he writes, "Man's power over nature turns out to be power exerted by some men over other men." It's rather sexist language by our standards, but the concept, I think, is absolutely right. And beware that phrase. Whenever you hear the phrase human beings' power over nature, beware, because so often it turns out to be power exerted by the strong over the weak. Along with this quest for self-transcendence is the idea that this very potent dream that technology is going to overcome the fundamental problems of humanity. It's going to make us better humans. If you take this list, these are what philosophers of a previous generation might have called the human condition. These are what human beings have struggled with since the dawn of time. You could find all of these in the biblical narrative, for instance. And until recently, this was taken as a given. These things were part of what it meant to be human. And therefore, we have to accept this as part of the created order. What is new is this idea that we don't have to accept any of these. We have the technology, and we can improve on humanity. We can make better humans. And a whole number of technologies are now being applied with the hope that they're going to solve these fundamental problems of the human condition. And what's interesting about these different technologies is that they are all driven by digital technology, by information technology. And as most of us know, information technology has this extraordinary phenomenon of Moore's law, that it is increasing in power, effectively doubling in power every 2 years. And that doubling in power has been going on since the 1950s and shows no sign of stopping. And therefore it means that the power of these technologies is increasing in this extraordinary way, year on year, as each year goes by. The power of these technologies is increasing. Now, obviously, looking forward into the future and trying to predict how fast these technologies are going to work and what their implications are going to be is a mug's game. And whenever we try and predict the future, we get it wrong. But we can see trends which are going on and which seem undeniable. This is the roof of the Sistine Chapel. And this is God, and it's the creation of Adam, with the spark of creation. Well, Economist magazine last year had a version of the same picture. I like it very much, the strategically placed laptop. But now, notice that the lightning spark is going in the opposite direction. There is no God. It's now Adam who has become the creator. And Adam is in the centre of the picture, is now creating life. And the Economist magazine had a fascinating review on synthetic life, which they call Biology 2.0, and the idea that of human beings now starting and creating life themselves. And this is a logarithmic scale, and this is the cost of computing, which is Moore's law expressed in another way, just showing how with every year that goes by. This is from 1999 to 2010. And so in computing, you're getting this dramatic increase in power and therefore reduction in cost. But the point of this was to show that when you take DNA sequencing, the rate at which the rate at which DNA sequencing is becoming cheap is going far faster than information technology. And therefore the power potentially behind genomics, DNA sequencing and so on is extraordinary. So this was the Economist, the normally staid Economist, said biology 2.0 will lead to better medical diagnosis and treatment, it will explain the history of life, and it will reveal in pitiless detail exactly what it is to be human. There it is again, the quest for self-transcendence. If only we can work out, we're now going to understand exactly what it is to be human by looking, by comparing ourselves now with the synthetic life that we create. There will be mistakes on the way and suffering too, but technology once invented cannot be unlearned. We are as gods and might as well get good at it. So pretty powerful stuff, but it is interesting how potent these dreams of being the creator. This is a little bit earlier in the century when the DNA code, the human DNA sequencing was first announced, and I was struck by the quasi-religious language which the broadsheets all assumed, opening the book of life and so on, a new beginning in which we finally accept that we are our own creators and we alone have the power to make a better world. Now this is what historians of thought would call the Enlightenment project. I mean, the European Enlightenment back in the 18th century developed the idea of using technology to create a better world. And interestingly, way back then, there are essays written by people like Diderot and others talking about how they're going to use this new technology to make better human beings. And they're going to use clockwork and the best technology of the time in order to create new and better human beings. It's taken 200 years, but the Enlightenment project is on course. And now technology has got to the point where it is actually possible to create better human beings. And so, again, what is collapsing is this distinction between the natural and the artificial. So again, historically, there was such a thing as the natural order, what is given, the way things are, what we have to accept. And then there were things that we made that were artifacts. Technology, what we make, the possibilities we create, what we can choose. But what is happening, again, is that this distinction is being blurred. And we live in an age where the artificial is so dominant that we're finding it increasingly hard to see the natural as a as an order of being in its own right. And in fact, it was Oliver O'Donovan who said that when everything is conceived in terms of making, when every human activity is conceived in terms of making, then the natural is seen as just as raw material, waiting for something to be made out of it. And so this dominant discourse of making a better world, making the future, building a new society, building a better world, building better bodies, it's this constant discourse. And so our bodies are just raw material, which we're going to make something better of. So the Enlightenment Project, building a better world through a combination of human ingenuity, science and rationality. Now what's interesting in this kind of thinking is that there is a great quest for freedom. We have to be free. We're human beings. We're not in bondage, we're free. But freedom is always conceived as freedom from the constraints and the limitations of the natural, or the natural order. So the idea is that we're going to break free from the limitations of nature, from the limitations of the bodies we've been given, and we're going to create truly free and liberated beings. And so technical enhancement is a big idea, and the idea of enhancing human bodies. And the argument goes that if we're capable of enhancing, if the technology actually becomes that we have a way of safely enhancing our children, then there's a moral duty on us to enhance our children. To choose not to enhance our children is morally equivalent to choosing an intervention to make them disabled. In both cases, the total happiness in the world is reduced. So if you see again this idea that if we can make a better world, then not to make a better world is actually morally evil. It is, there is a moral duty on us to make things better. And in this way of thinking, also the future is thought of as a human construct. We make the future block by block, choice by choice, by the choices we make now. And of course this leads to a crushing sense of responsibility. Unless we choose wisely, just think what possible consequences will be for the future. The choices we have now will determine the future we have. And so there is again a crushing sense of responsibility. There's a whole series of papers recently looking at the possibility of using technology for moral enhancement. I mean, after all, it's one thing to enhance our brains and enhance our human abilities, but what if we enhanced a new Hitler? What if some terrible consequences came from enhancing the abilities? So therefore, we should be using technology to enhance morally, to make sure that whoever these new enhanced human beings are, they're going to be morally acceptable and behave in good ways. And so these authors, Savulescu's here in Oxford, says if safe moral enhancements are ever developed, there are strong reasons to believe that their use should be obligatory, like educational fluoride in water, since those who should take them are least likely to be inclined to use them. That is, safe, effective moral enhancement would be compulsory. So get ready to be enhanced, because you're not going to be able to opt out. If you want to opt out, that proves that you definitely need the treatment. So this leads on to the sort of rather wacky end, which is transhumanism or post-humanism, this idea by using technology that we're going to create a better kind of human being. Transhumanists view human nature as work in progress, a half-baked beginning that we can learn to remould in desirable ways. Current humanity need not be the end point of evolution. Transhumanists hope that by responsible use of science, technology and other rational means, we shall eventually manage to become post-human beings with vastly greater capacities than present human beings have. And a recent paper on transhumanism had this interesting 4x4. They said, we don't know how fast this is going to go. There are different predictions. Some people say it's going to go really fast. The technology is going to take off. There's going to be some kind of singularity. And as the technology takes off, it's going to have all sorts of... Or it might go slow. And then, we don't know how much opposition there's going to be. Are there going to be all those people now called bioconservatives or neo-Luddites? Are they going to be really powerful and oppose this kind of technology, or are they going to be very weak? Well, the transhumanists say the best outcome was this all goes very fast and there's no opposition. That makes it promising but scary. The worst thing would be it's all very slow and there's strong opposition, in which case the Luddites rejoice. That's no doubt me, I'm sure. But if it goes fast but there's strong opposition, then there's going to be sparks. There's going to be real conflict in the future. But these are serious discussions that are going on to see how technology can be used to change human identity. And Ray Kurzweil, a very well-known technologist in the States, has argued that there's going to be a point at which machine intelligence exceeds human intelligence. And at that point, he says, all the bets are off. Because all of a sudden, all the jobs which were currently done by human beings we'll find can be done by machines. And that we can multiply them much faster. All of a sudden, the limitations which we've got, which are limitations of human intelligence and human creativity, are suddenly going to be taken off, because now we've got these super bright machines that aren't taking off exponentially. And so he calls that the singularity. So that's the far out reaches of this kind of thinking. How on earth do we respond from an Orthodox Christian perspective? And I'm just going to talk for 10 more minutes, and then there'll be a time for discussion and debate. But it seems to me that Christian ethics, the way we're called to treat one another, comes fundamentally from Christian anthropology, the way we're made. And therefore, what we need to develop as Christian people is we need to develop a more profound doctrine of creation and creation order. And one of the interesting things in the history of the Christian church has been that it's actually often been in the confrontation of theological debate and confrontation with heresy that the Christian church has developed new insights into the fundamental theological truths of the Christian faith. And so I genuinely believe there is a new opportunity that this whole environment we find ourselves in, which these fundamental questions about what it means to be a human being, they're offered to us as Christian people, those of you who are, the opportunity of discovering new insights into the biblical understanding, a Christian understanding of what it means to be human. And I think a new insights into the nature of the created order. And I think one of the profound insights of Christian thinking is that there is not just a physical order that God has created and that God upholds in the creation, but there is also a hidden, unseen moral order, a created moral order, which is in some sense like the warp and the woof of creation. And I think the image is something like a grain of wood. If you take a piece of wood, as we all know, wood has a certain grain into it. And if you live your life along the grain of creation, then your life will flourish, and that's what the Bible would call the way of wisdom. And if you live your life across the grain of creation, this hidden moral order which penetrates, then ultimately your life will fail and struggle, and that's what the Bible calls the way of folly. So wisdom is to discern this hidden moral order that penetrates reality and to try and live our lives according to this creation order. And one of the fundamental definitional points within the Genesis narrative, Genesis 1, is that human beings alone on the cosmos are made in God's image, in God's likeness. And this concept of the Imago Dei, of course, is one that has been rehearsed and examined and argued over for 2,000 years of Christian theology. But I think if we step back at a most fundamental, what the concept of the Imago Dei implies is that human beings are not self-explanatory. Because our meaning, our ultimate meaning as human beings, is derived from outside ourselves. Our meaning is not inherent within the structure of our bodies. It is derived outside ourselves. Why? Because we are godlike beings. We are created to be in God's image. And here's just a simple analogy. Suppose that some super intelligent alien intelligence on the Andromeda Galaxy is picking up through deep space an image. And you can imagine these alien intelligences examining every aspect of that image, dissecting it down in the most minute detail, examining the precise frequency absorption patterns of every pixel and of the precise relationship and geometrical arrangements of all these pixels and calculating the information inherent in this picture. They will not understand what they're looking at unless they recognize that it's a map. It's the London Underground map. And that those precise arrangements of lines and pixels actually reflect something else completely different, which is these strange metallic objects which trundle through various viaducts and tunnels in a particular part of the planet. In other words, these two things, which seem to be utterly and totally different, have a hidden connection. One is a map of the other. Now that's just an analogy, but in some way it seems to me that human beings are simply carbon-based life forms. We are simply primates. We are simply made out of the same stuff as everything else, but we map onto a different kind of reality, which is the nature and being of God Himself. And you will never understand, therefore, the unique human identity unless you understand that we are maps, that we are, in some sense, a reflection of another reality. But the other foundational text in the first chapter of Genesis is that we are made out of the dust of the earth, that human beings, a very fundamental nature, is that we are made out of dust. And that's so fundamental, is it, this connection, that the word in Hebrew, Adam, is taken from the word for ground, Adama. And in just the same way, did you know that human, the English derivation of human, is humus, not the stuff we put on our pita bread, but this compost heap. That is we are groundlings. And so fundamental is that relationship, is that it is put in our name. As we all know, in the Hebrew, the naming is profoundly significant. We are groundlings. And we are called groundlings in case we forget the embodied nature, the fact that we are made out of the same stuff as everything else. And we are therefore designed to share the limitations of the physical universe. And part of our design is that we are created to be physical and dependent and embodied, and as being a fundamental part of what it means to be a human being. And so this strange paradox, but at one and the same time, human beings are indescribably wonderful because we reflect God's being and God's character. But at the same time, we are groundlings. We are dependent. And this dependence is part of our fundamental stuff of our reality. And that's a very important message in in the modern technological world, because the quest for independence, the quest to be set free from the restrictions of the natural order, is so profound. So this myth that human beings are independent, choosing beings, is of course a profound folly. The truth is that you came into this world utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of other people. The very fact that you're sitting there looking reasonably healthy tells me that when you were born, somebody loved you. Somebody protected you, somebody kept you warm, somebody fed you, somebody wiped your bottom. Otherwise you wouldn't be here. None of us would be here. Then we go through a phase in our life when we discover that other people depend on us. I'm still going through that phase. I've got three grown-up boys, and they still depend on me and they say, "Dad, Dad, can you help me, Dad? Dad, can I have the car, Dad?" But then most of us are going to end our lives utterly and totally dependent on the love and care of others. And somebody else is going to look after us, and somebody else is going to feed us, and somebody else is going to wipe our bottoms. And that's not some terrible divine cock-up, to put it irreligiously. Actually, that is the way it was meant to be. This was brought home to me very powerfully some years ago when my mother developed a horrible form of progressive dementia. And in front of her eyes, she was transformed from being a very vivacious and creative woman into somebody who could do absolutely nothing for herself. She was incontinent. She was a dependent on 24-hour nursing care. She was confused, hallucinating. She could do absolutely nothing for herself. And near the end, I was visiting her in hospital, and somebody thrust a yogurt pot and a teaspoon in my hands, and I was trying to feed her. "Open your mouth, open your mouth, here it comes, open your mouth, here it comes." And then I suddenly had a flashback. This was precisely what she had done with me. I could even remember those words. And now, the tables were turned. But I remember thinking at the time, perhaps this is the way it was meant to be. I was learning more of what it meant to be a son, and she was learning more of what it meant to be a mother. Because dependence is part of our human story. And I think that's one of the main messages which, as Christian people, we have to say from creation, that this bizarre quest for independence is to fly in the face of the nature that God has given us. It's a complete folly. It can never be achieved. We are, by design, dependent beings, and dependence is part of our created nature. And then just to close, the most remarkable and stunning part of Christian theology, scandalous part, is that the God of the universe breaks into human history, so the Christian claim is, in the form of an original model, dust-laden human being. And he becomes utterly and totally dependent. He can do nothing for himself. He has to be fed. He has to be kept warm. He has to have his bottom wiped. And yet, the Christian faith tells us that at that very moment in which he is utterly and totally fragile, vulnerable, dependent, he is the one who is upholding the universe by the word of his power. So his dignity and status as the second person of the Trinity is in no way impaired by his vulnerability, by his dependence. And it's the same for us too. So please remember that. When you end up in some hospital bed and you need to be fed, and you need to be cared for, and you need to have your bottom wiped, please remember that in no sense is your dignity, your status as a godlike being, a unique and wonderful map of the Holy of Holies, ever in any way affected. And then in the resurrection, as Jesus is raised, a physical, touchable human being, made out of carbon atoms. Remember, the grave is empty. The resurrection accounts are adamant. The grave is empty. Those carbon atoms, those physical bits of phosphorus and mitochondria, are somehow caught up into this glorious resurrection body. We see God's final and eternal vote of confidence in the original human model. So the hope of a new, changed humanity is not through technological enhancement. It's not in some transhumanist dream. But it's through death and resurrection. And ultimately, as John says, when we see him, we shall be like him, for we shall see him as he is. So in Jesus, the original design of human beings is not abandoned, despised, or marginalized. In the person of Jesus, it is affirmed and fulfilled. Just close by telling you this story. This is Alan and Verity, very close friends of ours at All Souls Church in London, and they were married, been married for several years, longing to have a child, and then wonderful news, she's pregnant. We had a celebratory meal together, they were close friends of my wife and I. And then the news turns to tragedy. She's had various investigations. The baby has got a terrible, lethal congenital malformation, trisomy 18, Edwards syndrome. And in this situation, virtually everybody would recommend an abortion. What possible reason is there for carrying on a pregnancy when there is such a terrible and lethal abnormality? Surely the right thing to do is to take the life of the baby and protect the parents. But after a great deal of heart-searching, Alan and Verity felt that this child was the child that God had given them, and that they should love him and care for him. And little baby Christopher was born. He had all the signs of severe malformation. He had major brain abnormalities and heart problems. To everyone's surprise, he didn't die straight away, and in fact, he lived for a number of months. They were able to take him home, and he came to church regularly on Sundays, where he became a mini-celebrity and was passed around from arm to arm and was much loved and much cuddled. And he was a lovely little baby, in fact, very peaceful and quiet. And he gradually got weaker. He wasn't able to grow. He was just the same size. Eventually, after about 7 months, he got weaker and died. And at the memorial service at the church, about 400 people came to pay tribute to this tiny, pathetic little life. And as one of Alan and Christopher's friends said, Alan and Verity's friend said, although Christopher couldn't grow, he helped other people to grow. And it was true. And this is a strange thing, that sometimes we see the image of God not in the perfect specimens of humanity, not in the Olympic athletes, not in the Nobel Prize winners. Sometimes we see God more clearly in those who are struggling, in those who are less than perfect, in those who are in their human embeddedness struggle with the consequences of the creation and the fall. And ultimately, isn't this the Easter mystery, that we see God most clearly not in the powerful and the strong and the perfect specimens of humanity, but in the broken and bleeding body of a man on a cross? I'm going to stop there. Thanks very much.
Where do you draw the line? Because obviously we use medical technology all the time. We wear glasses, we do laser eye surgery, we benefit from that all the time. So at what point and on what basis does it become something that's scary and not like moral or something? So on what on what basis do you kind of think separate that, and could you give us a way to kind of understand
that? Thanks, yes. So did everybody hear the question? How do we tell the difference between, we use technology all the time for medicine, for treating conditions of various kinds. So how do we draw the line? When is technology inappropriate and when is it appropriate? Really, that's the question. And it's a very good question, and I don't have a very easy answer. But an analogy which I've used and which I think may be helpful, and that is that in a Christian way of thinking, human beings are not so much raw material that can be made into anything, but they have their own intrinsic dignity. And I think the way of thinking, therefore, is a human being is like a masterpiece, or like a Dutch master, but that is flawed and damaged. And therefore, medicine becomes something like art restoration. And I did a bit of research on art restorers, and it turns out that art restorers have a code of ethics, like doctors. And the code of ethics for art restorers says that you can use technology in order to restore the masterpiece, but the artist's original design is normative. In other words, you must never use your technology to fundamentally change the design. Now, that's just some kind of analogy, but I think it's helpful. In other words, we can use medical technology to restore the masterpiece, to put it back to the way that humanity was meant to be, but we shouldn't use the technology to actually change the design. So, for instance, suppose that you have some kind of genetic abnormality which leads on to quite serious disease. If it was possible to, using highly sophisticated genetic technology, to craft artificial chromosomes, maybe from a yeast, and then implant them into the cells and infect cells so that you could then restore by gene therapy, put them all back to normal. That seems to me, although very high tech, restoring the masterpiece. But if I was to use the same technology to make a runner who can run faster than a 10-second mile, 10-second, 100 metres, or to enhance human intelligence, see if we can make someone have an IQ of 200 or something like that, then it seems I'm changing the design. So it is, I think, that way of thinking that sees there is a fundamental order to the way that human beings are made, and it's that order which is, it seems to me, affirmed in the person of Jesus.
You just mentioned intelligence as one place you might not want to enhance. What if you take somebody whose genetics means that they're likely to be born with what would be quite below the normal on the bell curve, and genetically you could bring them up to what we would consider to be normal for the population?
Yeah, did you hear the question then? What about if somebody was born with a low intelligence? Would it be appropriate to bring them to normal? Yes, and I think the answer to that is yes. And for instance, we would do that, for instance, with hypothyroidism, which is often associated with intellectual disturbance. By giving people thyroid replacement, we're helping to bring their... So I think, again, there is at least conceptually a difference between restoring to the normal range versus enhancing. I mean, there are lots of difficulties here. I'm not pretending that this is a sort of silver bullet which solves all the problems. I mean, one of the big ethical dilemmas that paediatricians have had is it right to use growth hormone to increase the stature, the height of children who are completely normal but just at the bottom end of the bell curve? So if they're going to grow and they're only going to be 5'6", there's lots of evidence saying that if you're small, sorry to the small people here, you get discriminated against in all sorts of ways, and a bit of growth hormone could then help to push you up. Now, is that an appropriate use of technology, or are we using technology actually about prejudice then? This is about prejudices in society. Is it appropriate to use technology to try and overcome the effect of human prejudice, or should we be trying to tackle the prejudice more directly?
Yeah, I just want to build up. Was that for me or someone behind me? Okay, I'll stop.
I just wanted, John, speakers were those 5'6" people.
Yeah, I'm sorry.
Who was, by the way, actually offered growth hormone.
Well, there you go.
In the days when it was a kind of prion soup, in fact.
So you were probably rather glad you didn't have it.
But I wonder, the point you've just made, I wonder whether that's the key, that's something that I really took from your talk, is that underlying this distinction you're making is something about the value of human beings as we are. And in a sense, wearing glasses or being made to be well again, it is affirming not only that individual human being, but actually humankind, human yeah. beings. Whereas the transhumanist approach, almost by its Inception is devaluing human beings and what we are. And so, in a way, I mean, I wondered whether your comment about moving people up the bell curve was rather somebody whose IQ was, let's say, 95, and had nothing wrong with them, and was just a normal 95, and if we had some magic cure, quotes, cure for stupidity, as it were, you know, that could bring them up by 10 points to the other end of the, to 5 points the other side of the normal, would you want to do it? And it seems to me the answer is you wouldn't, because it would undervalue people whose IQ was 95, and what we should actually be doing is recognising that everybody's IQ is...
I think my point is more, I mean, 95 is arbitrary, right? Why not 85 or 75 or 65? You know, if you keep shifting it down, you draw a hard line.
Sure. I think that was exactly my point, that actually you're still dealing then with supporting people who are already human beings, whereas if we're then trying to make people to be something they're not, we're actually devaluing what human beings really are, and that seems to be what the transhumanists start with, the assumption that human beings are not really very good.
Yes, I think that's absolutely right, and I suggest to give it you as a project that you listen out in the popular discourse, particularly popular science discourse, of how often in popular science there is something which is effectively demeaning of humanity. You know, that our brains are pretty useless, our memories are no good, our cells are constantly degenerating, we're constantly self-deluding ourselves, our illusions of self-control are purely that illusory, and so on. Because it seems like there's this constant theme that is demeaning of human beings. And I think it's the other half of the coin. You have to demean the present in order to encourage people to go for the new Mark II human being.
This chappy. You very courteously gave me his two.
I'm probably building off what Bethany was asking. I'm not sure that there's such a thing. It seems to be in your talk there was a, which I agree with so much of, that there was an idea of sort of pure nature. And like I tend to think, in terms of like anthropology or something, when people start using tools, that they're no longer tools, it actually changes the way we conceive of what it means to be and act as a human. So wearing glasses or just using a spade or various things like this. So it seems to me, though, that you don't need a concept of pure nature. You can talk more in terms of... What is the relationship between virtuous character and actions towards ends? So what are the ends of this particular technological enhancement? And for that you need a story about what it means to be in community with people, and we get that from the gospel narratives and these kinds of things. But that, it seems to me that talk of pure nature is incredibly illusory.
Well, pure nature is your term.
Right.
I didn't use that term. I said created order.
Well, you had the nature and the artificial distinctive.
Do you think created order is illusory?
No. But I don't think our creativity, using technology and so on, has any problem with that. So I think it's very hard to... draw a line around what we could do to enhance our bodies, like Peter was saying, to make ourselves more intelligent or whatever. But the question seems more to me about to what end, or is it toward the end of communion with each other and fellowship with God, or is it towards the end of strong over weak and these various other things I said, which is not a question of, I mean, there's still an order there, but it's an order that goes towards a teleological conception of what it means to be in relationship with people and God, doesn't go towards nature as such.
Yes. I think there probably is a fundamental difference between us then, I think, in this understanding of... I mean, I think, again, I would agree with all of that.
Right.
And, of course, that there is a telos in our created order. But it does seem to me there is something about the incarnation and resurrection which is... an affirmation of humanity as originally given. So therefore I do have a concept of humanity as originally given, rather than humanity being something that is in flux, that is something as, therefore, conceptually. Because conceptually, you would have to, if one took your position, you would have to say that if by these transhumanism we could make better communities, well, let's go for it. If we could enhance, you know, use technology to enhance our ability to relate to one another, well, then why not? Wouldn't you? If you say that's the telos of human beings, that we can use technology, maybe these moral enhancements would be an appropriate tool. So I think that's the challenge which the technology offers to us.
Isn't that what one of the primary things that technology does, right? I mean, so like telephone, Facebook, it helps us to relate together
yes.
in an easier way. And I think I'm struggling maybe a little bit, and I loved your talk, thank you. I should start there. I guess I'm just struggling to think about maybe something that Joel was picking up on is, you know, the fact that there is disease and death, and even that, you know, Christ had to die, and all this is also part of God's created order. So at what point do we start saying, well, this is, you know, to be human doesn't include these bits of sickness, and I'm not quite understanding, you know, how much of God's brokenness in
yeah.
our, do we accept, and at what point do we say, you know, technology should be inserted, I guess.
Thanks very much. Well, I think that's a very, very profound and interesting question, isn't it? So the question is, what about the fact of disease and suffering in the universe, and to what extent is this part of the created order, and it's part of God's brokenness, and so on. And these are, of course, profound and complex, but they penetrate absolutely to the heart of what we're talking about. Which is, in a way, although I didn't get, because it's a whole new theological thing about the fall and about the nature of evil and the mystery of evil and so on. But in a way, by showing baby Christopher, the reason I showed baby Christopher was really to hint in that direction, that it's often, bizarrely, what the Christ event teaches us is that it's often through the weak and the imperfect and those who struggle that God himself enters into the weakness and the fragility and the brokenness of his creation in order to not to overcome suffering and evil, but to redeem it, to work through it. Now, these are profound theological themes, but I think they all tie in, therefore, with whether, maybe this comes back to the question of the telos, the ultimate goal of humanity. Is it to be stronger and brighter and fitter and more powerful and more dynamic? Or actually, is it more that through our weakness and our fragility and our brokenness, the power of God is going to be revealed, and then ultimately through the resurrection into the new heaven and new earth? These are profound, deep issues, I think. But the interesting thing is how technology, you know, they come from a different angle, don't they? These are ancient theological issues, but they are, technology throws a new light on them.
And I was struck by the John Harris quote, which presumed that technological enhancement would bring happiness.
Yeah.
And my wife was an interpreter for the deaf, and I was reminded of a controversy years ago over cochlear implants.
Yes.
And the deaf children of deaf parents, the parents were put under a lot of pressure for the children to be given cochlear implants because the assumption was they would be able to hear, therefore they'd be happy. And the parents very often resisted and said, you have no right to assume that. In fact, you're demeaning our deaf culture by making that assumption. And I thought that was really quite an interesting take, and I wondered what you thought of it.
Yes, so thank you very much. I think that's absolutely right. And it's another way of making the same point, isn't it, that actually this blithe assumption, which is an enlightenment assumption, that improved functioning equals improved happiness, improved well-being, just doesn't work out in practice. And there's lots of empirical evidence to show that if you just measure subjective well-being, it doesn't correlate with levels of functioning at all, above a certain threshold effect. And I think there's a strange paradox again. You know, so many of these profound paradoxes about what it means to be human is that he's often in weakness and in disability. Just last week, I was speaking at a conference for Christian disability people with disabilities, and it was a very moving occasion because these were people often with profound disabilities of one sort or another, but who the transparent integrity and power of their lives spoke so well. And those paradoxes are very, very real. And so it does seem to me that part of the witness of Christianity in this age in which the development of the perfect is the goal, part of the witness of Christianity is to do with this, the paradox of the God who comes in our brokenness and who reveals himself in weakness.
Gentlemen, I understand you correctly, you related the possibility of some sort of engineered superhuman to a normal, say, God-created human in fairly oppositional terms, and that to me seems to just be playing along with the opposition between something man-made versus God-made. And isn't that just the modern framework that needs to be moved on from if something kind of Christian and ethical is going to be preserved, and is going to function as some kind of a real alternative to this whole modern project? I don't really understand how you have to do this, because it came to, across to me as just the same kind of opposition.
I think opposition in the sense that ontologically there is a difference between an artifact and something which is natural. That Oliver O'Donovan writes that he says that when you take a bath, you are confronted by something completely and utterly natural, which is your body. I always smile about that, because when I take a bath, I'm just sort of trying to get washed, but when Oliver O'Donovan takes a bath, he's reflecting on the natural order. But nonetheless, it's an interesting idea. He says we are confronted, you know, when we confront our own bodies, these are not things which in any sense we made or anyone else made. And that distinction between something which is given to us as in a natural order versus the thing which we have made, is that oppositional? I would just say it's an ontological distinction, that fundamentally these have different orders of being, and that wisdom is to recognize that they have different orders of being and to blur the distinction, to say actually there's no difference, I think is unhelpful. That's, I think, my response. I don't want to have I'm trying to avoid a crude opposition of saying that technology is bad and that nature is good. I hope that's not what I'm trying to say. That you know, my work is in a highly technologically sophisticated area of medicine, and it would have been impossible without the advances in science and technology, which is, you know, and there are many examples where of the benefits of technology. But I do believe that this technology does carry with it a dark side, and that it does lead to a certain blurring of distinctions, which conceptually I think we need to keep apart, at least in our minds.
Right. Okay, so through your talk, something I've been thinking about is in terms of what medicine is, or what medicine is supposed to do. I guess sort of traditionally we've thought of it as fixing things that are wrong, in the sense of something being wrong when it doesn't work properly or when it's not what a normal person has. And I'm wondering if maybe these transhumanists are just trying to redefine medicine in terms of not just fixing what is wrong by reference to what is normal or what is proper functioning, fixing what is wrong by reference to what is ideal or how we think things should be. And in a sense that sounds rather Christian, because we all, as Christians, we believe in a fallen world. We believe there's an originally created good order. We also believe in a fallen world. And we believe, to take the moral enhancement thing, that, you know, we are fundamentally flawed in the way we reason morally. So, I mean, given those things, and given that we are looking forward to a new creation where all of these things will be fixed, what's wrong with them trying to build it here and now?
So, you're right that, the medical enterprise, traditionally conceived, well, of course, if you go back along before the second part of the 20th century, medicine wasn't able to fix very little, and therefore, traditionally, it was much more a sort of companionship, a covenant of care with the sick patient. Then you get the rise of medicine that can really do things, and it does tend to regard itself then as fixing things. I think philosophically that there needs to be a goal of medicine, and it's one of the interesting things that doctors by and large don't think about. They don't really think about what the goal of medicine is, what its aims are. But it would seem to me that it is to do with human flourishing. It's to do with trying to help people become what they are. So again, if you take the Enlightenment view that sees the natural order as constraining, and that human freedom is to break out from this claustrophobic constraint, I think by contrast, an Orthodox Christian understanding would see that the goal of human beings is that they should become the person they're meant to be, that we're in the process of becoming who we are. And that there is therefore a goal, a telos for human beings to become the person that God meant me to be. Now that raises other questions, but I would see it as a telos within the created order. God's design for us is not to break out from the constraints of the created order, but is to become the person we were meant to be within the order. That is to live your life along the grain of the created order. It doesn't give a neat answer, but I would say that this making thing, of making, that goes along with technology, has no end. It has no ultimate telos. It sort of goes on and on and on and on and on. And the human has become the raw material for making.
I think I have a problem with the ontological categories that you've sort of set up and seem to make quite distinctly in your thoughts, as your argument rests on this nature or created order versus artifact distinction. And I can go along with it in the sense that I think something in a galaxy far, far away which no human agent has ever interacted with, you could think of as purely natural or created order. Mm. But the human body, contrary to what the quote from O'Donovan, it seems to me if we didn't use our agency to get up in the morning and to feed ourselves on the physical level, if we're going to make a mind-body distinction, and then to educate our minds to reflect, we wouldn't be what we are. We probably wouldn't even be alive. So whilst we're not pure artifact, we're not pure created order either, and there's some sense of co-creation, which I think is right there from the Genesis story, with Adam being given a creative commission by God, but only having been given that by God, not something that he has autonomously or independently. And I wonder if we need to actually to think about this, break down that sort of binary distinction, say that there is a co-creation, and that would have an impact on how we think.
Yeah. So the question was, is there in some sense in which we are co-creators, that we are in ourselves as human beings involved in the creation of our own identity and so on? And I mean, that's certainly an honourable theological tradition. Of the created co-creator, that that God delegates to human beings the ability to create. Now, I would say there's a sense in which that's true. So there's a sense in which we are, of course, given and delegated, and you can see that in the Genesis narrative, can't you? All the forms of technology and creativity, which were given. But it seems to me that when it comes to ourselves, our identities, then the idea that I can decide who John Wyatt is at an ultimate level, I create John Wyatt, seems to me that that's idolatry, ultimately. That my meaning, because of the Imago Dei, that a fundamental nature of human beings is that we reflect another being. We are not our own creations. And Donovan makes a distinction, therefore, between creating and begetting. So he says that which we create is different from us and is ours to control. That which we beget comes from our being and is equal to us in dignity and status. And so he says we beget children, we don't create them. And he uses this to go back to the Nicene Creed, that the Son is begotten, not made, that the Church Fathers drew this distinction. That's another way of seeing of drawing a distinction between we are given a gift of human identity and we pass it on to our children versus what we do with our artifacts. So again, I think I'm coming back, I'm still defending there is a distinction, and that although co-creation is an honourable theological tradition, ultimately, if you wish to apply it that we are co-creating ourselves, I would have to depart at that point.
How about excess body fat? Is
that how about excess body fat? Sorry, it's good.
Is excess body fat created or
not created? It's not created.
Well, undoubtedly the choices we make affect our body, but it doesn't affect the nature of your ultimate nature of your humanity, does it? I mean, however ravaged, because one of the wonderful insights of Christian theology is that however ravaged a body is, however malformed, however affected by disease, its fundamental dignity, its godlikeness, cannot be eradicated. And that, why? Because ultimately it is an alien dignity. I think that was, I can't remember who said that, one of the great theologians, that human beings carry an alien dignity. Our dignity is comes ultimately from God.
Thank you very much, Professor White. I think we'll stop the question.